The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. He must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
All right, back by popular demand, we are in the LA Live studio. Al Michaels, who gave us one of the best podcasts I think we've ever had, and he's back. And hopefully we won't be running back the same stories. We're going to try to go in a couple different directions. But Al, a pleasure for you to have you here.
Well, by international demand, as you know.
Oh, yeah, tell that story.
Because last March, I went to Israel for the first time with my wife, and we were part of a group that was led by Bob Kraft, the owner of the Patriots, and his late wife, Myra, who was there, and of course passed away in July. And the Kraft family has built a stadium where they play semi-pro football in Jerusalem.
Wow.
So we go out on Friday night just for the coin toss and the opening ceremony, and Bob wanted the party to come out and see what's going on. Pouring rain. So Bob and I are down on the field before the game. Can't wait to get out of there. But right after the coin flip, all of a sudden the referee sees me on the sideline, makes a beeline for me, and he's got this big, like, you know, Mulgan David beard. And the guy who has to be, I guess, the Ed Hockley of Jerusalem goes, "Heard you on Simmons podcast. That was great. When are you doing it again?" I'm going, "What?
Unbelievable.
Where am I?" So you're big in Jerusalem. You're big. I don't know that you're that big on the West Bank necessarily, but Jerusalem, Haifa, and Tel Aviv, you're a star.
I can't believe that. I wonder if they know how much Middle East poli-sci I took in college back in the day.
How much?
I used to be very familiar with that whole area.
Hmm.
Now I can't remember everything, but I was big. I think I wrote a whole term paper on the Gaza Strip once upon a time.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Well, if you can get into the Golan Heights, that'll increase the rating.
How long
10,
were you there?
15%. We were there for a week. And
Bob Kraft's wife? Was she sick at that point?
No. Well, yeah. What happened was right after everybody got back, Myra went into the hospital and was in and out of the hospital. And Myra had been ill and then had recovered. And she was a fantastic woman. And people have no idea what the Kraft family has done in Israel. Because, I mean, we saw people who, I mean, she impacted their lives. I mean, there are a lot of people who make a big deal of doing things. The Kraft family doesn't. They just do things, and it's not just money. But I saw what Myra did with schools and with hospitals and all of that. And I mean, you know, they make this thing about the fact that she had died, and the Patriots all year long will wear the patch that obviously honors the memory of her. But she was, I mean, she was the real deal. She was a spectacular woman.
And you could tell that from columns, the features, the tweets, even some of the stuff the player said after. I thought, you can see through this stuff sometimes. And
I think you can.
You know, I don't, Al Davis just died. Obviously had a great career, did a lot of good things. But it seems when people die sometimes, the narrative loves, they're doing this for Al Davis and all that. And it's like, in that case, I really doubt the Raiders had that much of a connection with Al Davis. I do think he had an unbelievable career.
Right.
But with the case of Bob Kraft's wife, Myra, it really did seem like she touched a lot of lives.
I've had the great pleasure of knowing, the Krafts for as long as Bob has owned the team. And I got to know Myra extremely well. And she was a wonderful woman because it was always understated.
Yeah.
If you didn't know what she did, you'd never know.
Right.
But then you'd hear and see and watch. And so that's, the Boston Herald had her on the cover right after she had died. And the three words, heart of gold. And that's exactly what she had.
The only time she was really heard from was the one time the Patriots drafted this guy, Christian Peter.
Right.
From Nebraska, who had a lot of trouble and some domestic violence incidents and things like that. And she got mad and she spoke up and they waived the guy the next day. And everybody... Right. For about a year, the joke was that, look who's wearing the pants in the Patriots family. But, probably the right move.
You know, you're allowed to do that once every 15 years if you're the owner's wife,
yes,
aren't you?
I think you are. Al Davis, last month you had a comment about something saying about, I think something like they wouldn't win a Super Bowl again until he passed away, something like that. And then people blew that out of proportion and did the whole sports blogosphere routine on it.
Sure. I'm walking out of a restaurant. It's TMZ. And I have fun with TMZ. And somebody said, well, the Raiders ever won a Super Bowl. I mean, you could have asked me about 25 different teams or owners or whatever. It's like, you know, in Cincinnati, will the Bengals ever win a Super Bowl?
Yeah, Mike Brown passed away.
And, you know, first of all, there are 32 teams in the league. So the chances of you winning the Super Bowl basically are 32-1. And it was just a case of walking out and saying, you know, no. So then it's blown up into this whole thing. And the history, of course, there is that I used to get along famously with Davis in the early years. Hmm. In fact, he...
Is that because you were in San Francisco?
Yes. I mean, going all the way back. Well, even before that. I mean, my father was a television executive in the 60s and made the original American Football League television contract.
Wow.
It sat on my... on my kitchen table when I was going to high school, and we had grown up in New York, and then we moved here. So I went to all the L.A. Chargers.
Is there any
games.
Part of your life that didn't intersect with some sort of sporting thing?
It's crazy.
You really are Zelig.
Right. I've been to a lot of places. I've seen a lot of things. I was there, and I mean, my father worked for Lou Wasserman at the time at MCA.
What?
Sonny Werblin was there, and he owned the Jets. We go all the way back. So I've known Ralph Wilson and Bud Adams and knew Lamar Hunt from the time I was a kid, a child. And Davis, I got to meet Davis early on, and he knew my father because my father was involved in the television process there. And then we were very friendly. And in the early 90s on Monday Night Football, you know, Davis was always a guy who enjoyed being mysterious.
Right.
And I convinced him to do a Monday Night halftime interview. The Raiders were playing in Kansas City. And I felt it was a disservice that Davis was not in the Hall of Fame at that point because he had done just
what year
so
are we talking about?
Early 91 or 92.
Okay.
So, I mean, Davis had been around for a long time. He'd done all the things that he had, coaching and owning a team and the commissioner and helping to facilitate the merger. And I just felt I had heard that because of, you know, some personal dislike on the part of some of the electors that Davis was being kept out of the Hall of Fame. So I said, Al, I said, can we do a halftime interview on Monday night? No, I really don't want to do it. I said, listen, I said, I normally don't want to be an advocate in things like this, but I feel you should be in the Hall of Fame.
Right.
And I think we can talk about certain things. Now, I want to say at the end of the piece that my feeling is that you should be in the Hall of Fame. And if you're being kept out because of the personal dislike of some electors, it's a bogus deal.
This is very Cosellian of you.
Very. And I believe this is, I did this. And Davis agreed to do the interview. We did a very good interview.
Yeah.
One of the things he said, it's one of the first times he said he wanted to be known as a Maverick, which became part of his obituary, the fact that he enjoyed being described as that. So we do the interview. It plays at halftime. I say what I say coming out of the piece. The following year, it's not like it is now where, you know, they announced the Hall of Fame inductees the day of the Super Bowl. They did it apart from any game. He gets into the Hall of Fame.
Oh.
He calls me at home. He says, and I can't imitate, you know, the way what he sounds like, but the word I was like A-H. I just want to thank you so much. He said, this wouldn't have happened without you. He said, you know, I'm in the office and I called Caroli, his wife, and you're the second call I've made. I went,
wow.
I said, Al, listen, you got yourself into the Hall of Fame. I just felt that, you know, I thought it would be a good idea for people to see you in a different circumstance, different light, Monday Night Football halftime, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, fine. I mean, I didn't do it for that particular reason, except I just felt it was a disservice.
Well, plus your love of Al's.
Well, right, my love of Al's, of course. So we the following year, now, fast forward, so what do we have going on? Marcus Allen.
Oh.
So this is where it all fell apart with me and with Davis, because here was Marcus, and I knew that Marcus, I'd known Marcus pretty well. Marcus was very upset. And the irony was, I had talked to Marcus about, do you want to, you know, go on the air and say something Monday night? You know, that's the biggest
still
audience.
Playing, yeah.
Marcus is still playing, but he's on the bench.
Right.
Now, this is he's still with the Raiders.
Yep.
He's on the Raiders, but this was where I do the interview with Marcus. He agrees to do the interview and says that Davis is devaluing his career, and Davis is basically telling Art Shell not to play him.
Hmm.
So, I mean, this is a monster thing that happens at halftime in the middle of a game we're doing in Miami, Raiders at Miami. One of the things that helped me get that thing done, the irony here is that Jim Murray, the great columnist for the Los Angeles Times for years and years and years, who was a great friend of Al Davis, had written a column about 3 weeks prior, because the Raiders are playing in L.A., about how, you know, Marcus Allen is the lost soul on the Raider bench. What's going on? And, you know, Murray did it in his inimitable way, and Marcus opened up to Murray, and that led me to ask Marcus if he would do this. And he did. So now, of course, you have this interview. So the dynamic was the following, Bill. If I'm going to do the interview with Marcus, I can't run it through the Raiders. Of course they're not going to let this thing happen. So we do the interview. We tape it on Saturday in L.A. I fly to Miami. Raiders fly to Miami. We get there, and on a Monday morning, I call Davis in the hotel room in Miami, and I say, hey, Al, I said, you're not going to be thrilled about this. But, you know, we have our halftime interview tonight with Marcus Allen. I said, I'm going to read to you everything that's going to air, and I'm going to read you the outtakes. And I went through it, and he was dispassionate. He said, let me call you back. I said, the other thing, look, this is going to run for 3.5 minutes, so we're going to give you 3.5 minutes if you want to come on live. We can tape an interview. You can give me a statement. Whatever you want to do, you can say nothing. He wound up calling me back and giving me a statement. I wrote every word down. I said, let me read to you what you say. Bang. All right, so we do that, but there's such consternation. It's a big national story. I mean, here's Marcus Allen going to the locker room at halftime knowing all hell is breaking loose on national television on Monday night. Of course, the Raiders go home, and it's a gigantic story. And Davis, of course, never forgave me for being a party to this. So from that point on, we went from thanking me to help him get into the Hall of Fame to the enemy. And so that's, you know, so that's the history of that. And he was, like he was a very good grudge holder, too.
That's what I was going to say.
So be it. So be it. I mean, hey, Bill, in this business, you know, you deal with a ton of people. You try to be fair. You try to be even-handed. And sometimes, you know, it just breaks down and can never be repaired.
What are some of the owners, what are some of the other owners that have stood out for you? Because now you've been... Since what, 85 for Monday Night Football?
86 to 05.
25, 26 years
26
now.
26 season. Right.
Probably rubbed some shoulders with some pretty rich people, some powerful people.
Sure.
You said Kraft and Meyer Kraft stood out a little bit. Who else?
Well, yeah, I mean, I just find Bob Kraft to be, you know, he's to me, kind of the model owner in a way. Look, he's got a tremendous franchise, and, you know, as a New England guy, you know,
he saved the Patriots.
You know all about
this. We were going to St. Louis.
But he's a good man. He's got a great heart. Look, you can find warts with everybody. I happen to think Jerry Jones is one of the best owners in sports. You can argue that up one side and down the other.
He's 97% there. That he thinks he should also be the GM is his issue.
Well, you know what? But he does know a lot about football.
But he shouldn't be the GM.
Well, but he has people that he listens to.
No, he doesn't.
Yeah, well, he brought Parcells in. If you're going to be the GM, remember, give Jerry some credit here.
And Parcells left.
But Parcells was there for 4 years.
The Roy Williams trade is a classic. You're not listening to your football people if you make that
there
trade.
There are tons of horrible trades that have been made through the years. So, look, Jerry, first of all, Jerry getting that stadium built
was amazing.
Is an amazing accomplishment. I don't care what anybody says. That's the greatest stadium I've ever seen. Period.
Yeah.
Period. And they didn't chintz on one thing.
No. Nope.
He spent... I mean, the infrastructure, you walk around, you go, wow, and they finished that, and they finished that. I'm going, holy man, this is impossible. Give him credit. And Jerry Jones, in the middle of building the stadium, you got the complete financial meltdown.
Right.
And I remember saying to him as they were opening up the stadium in 09, we did the first game in there, the first regular season game. I went, you know, and I'd known him for years and watched this process develop. And I went, man, didn't you wake up at night and say, I can save $100 million. I don't have to do that. I don't have to put the curtains over here. And Jerry said, yep. He said, but I tell you, he said, that what made me motivated to get it all done is, he said, I've got one time to do this. It's now.
Right.
It's now or it's never. So I've got to, you know, I have to have the faith that the economy will get better. This will work. I got one chance at it. And that's what I love about him, because he will take chances.
Right. And well, he also knew that the sweet money, the way these new stadiums are structured, that's a lot of money you're leaving on the table every year if you don't build a stadium.
Well, you have. That's what the stadiums are about, suites right now. But to build what he did is tremendous. Most of these guys, I've known all the owners through the years, and it, look, they take a lot of guff and grief.
Snyder's a guy who's taken a lot of stuff.
Of course he
deserves
has.
Himself for the most part.
Well, on a number of levels, yeah, you can go around and say, hey, how could he do this? How could he do that? The one thing about him, though, he lives and dies with winning and losing.
Right.
I mean, almost over the top. I mean, but he is a guy. I mean, it's the end of the earth if they lose, and he's over the top if they win. But then he starts worrying about next week's game. Look, this is why we love sports. This is why it is so great to be able to own a team, because you're invested in this thing. And you can sort of, you know, control certain aspects of it. And then the great thing about, you know, owning a team or coaching a team or playing is that at the end of the day, you walk out of the stadium and the scoreboard lights tell you whether you won or lost.
Yeah.
Contrast that with, like, you know, broadcasting. Look, I love what I do. I've got the greatest job in the world. But at the end of the day, there are no lights that tell me what to do. I mean, for years it used to be, how would Rudy Marsky treat you in USA Today in his television
column? So much power.
Did you win or you lose? I'm going, what is this? This is crazy nonsense. And they used to talk to, like, coaches who would go into broadcasting, and they'd say the same thing. They'd say, the one thing they miss is, what happened? Let me walk off the field. How do the lights line up on that board? I know what I did. But in broadcasting, it's different.
Well, you must, these last couple years, I feel like, with Collinsworth, you know, you must have been a little worried you weren't going to find the same rhythm that you had with Madden. I feel like you've been better with Collinsworth. Now, that's a little bit controversial.
Well, let me just say,
Collinsworth,
opinion.
I feel, it's just my feeling.
You've been known to have an opinion.
I know. Collinsworth, I feel like, has invigorated you like about 15%. And I thought you did a good job with Madden.
I've said this before, and I'll say it again. I mean, I felt like with John, I had 7 years with John, four at Monday night.
You have to be like a tiny bit deferential with him because he's John Madden. Even if you know you're not doing it.
I had DiMaggio, and then I got Mantle when DiMaggio retired. That's how I look at these guys. The great thing about John Madden is that when we started together in 02, and there were a couple of periods along the way where we thought we were going to get him in the early 90s,
right?
In the late 90s, and then he went from CBS to Fox, and then Fox renewed. We tried to get him in the late 90s in 1998, and then finally it happens. And people, I know some people were saying, oh, how's this going to work? I mean, from the get-go, I had known John not particularly well, but I'd known him for a lot of years, again, going back to the Bay Area.
Yeah.
And we knew it was going to work, and we did. The first game we did was the Hall of Fame game in 2002 in Canton. Got to the first commercial, and I feel like I've been working with John for 15 years. I mean, and we talked about it in the car on the way back afterwards, and it rolled and it flowed. You don't, when you have a great relationship, on-air relationship with a partner, you don't think about the mechanics of who's going to talk when, who's singing what, how, where.
It sounds like a real life relationship.
You're sitting exactly.
Yeah. If you're analyzing what's happening in your relationship all the time, it's probably not going well.
And I had 7 years with John. They were fantastic. And then, you know, it shocked me when John retired after the Super Bowl in January of 09, which, by the way, may have been my favorite game ever to do, Arizona-Pittsburgh, which you can make a case for being the best Super Bowl.
Two of the best players in Super Bowl history.
I thought our production crew had a phenomenal night. You had two of the greatest plays in the history of the Super Bowl, with Harrison running the interception back at the end of the half and Holmes making the catch at the end of the drive to win the game, and every picture was, like, perfect.
Yeah.
So our guys in the truck, just they were singing. And I thought John had a tremendous game, and I never had a greater feeling walking out of a booth than after that game. It was like, wow, we had the Super Bowl we always wanted, and bang, everybody was on the same page. So it shocked the hell out of me when John retired. But I mean, so
maybe you wanted to go out with a bang.
Well, John wouldn't have made the decision predicated on that. John is a very thoughtful man, and there were a lot of components that went into that. And I don't think that had anything to do with it. That game could have been 48-0, and John still would have retired.
All right.
I'm convinced of that. But, I mean, to know that I had those 7 years with John, and at the very end you walk out and have, you know, this telecast for the ages, at least in your mind.
Yeah.
And then I got Chris. I found Chris by watching a game maybe 17 years ago. He was doing a college game. And I said to my wife, and she'll tell you this, I said, that guy's good.
Yeah.
And I'd known him a little bit. I'd covered him in college. I was doing college football, and I'd done a bunch of Florida games. Not that I'd gotten to really know him, but then I knew him afterwards, the Cincinnati connection. So,
I knew him for 20 years, basically.
Right. Well, when I'm going to Sunday Night Football in 06, and Dick Ebersole, running NBC, comes to me and he says, here's the deal.
I traded you for a rabbit.
No, yeah, we'll get back to that. That's another thing. Believe me, that deal was done. The rabbit got thrown at the end. Just said,
rabbit to be named later.
They threw the press off. Yeah. Rabbit to be named later. So the deal was with that. Ebersole said to me, I'm going to sign you guys, you and John, for 6 years, the six-year duration. At that time, now it's become eight. Mm. But at that time, it was six. He said, if for some reason John doesn't last the six, I've got Collinsworth in the bullpen. He's going to be on the Football Night in America pregame show.
And they had him do play-by-play before they knew they could get you, right?
Oh, yeah, there was a moment in time when... And Chris was thrilled to death because... The analyst, you see, the roles are different to the extent the play-by-play announcer has to watch the actual
too much stuff.
Game.
They're on the 39, they're in the red hash mark,
The analyst has the ability. Why are analysts so good sometimes? Because they're watching the left guard taking on the inside linebacker, which if you're doing the play-by-play, if you start watching that, next thing you know, there's a guy running 70 yards for a touchdown, and you don't know what just happened.
It's two different skill sets.
Exactly.
It's only worked once, though. Tennis, when the McEnroe brothers did it together, it was great. But I think it has to be a sport. Yeah, I think it could work with baseball potentially, too, just because there's so little action.
Yeah.
And but football, no way.
Well, tennis is
no way it works.
Well, tennis is almost all analysis. You're not going, the ball goes here, the ball goes there, the ball goes here. No, you're not
you're
doing
going,
that.
Oh,
you're not
he looks
back.
Like his confidence
tennis
is shaking.
Tennis is all analysis.
Yeah. So... Collinsworth, I always thought was going to be great as a color guy. Let me ask you this, because Francona, we're taping this like last weekend, Francona replaced McCarver, Francona, for a couple of baseball games. And he was great. He was a natural. And I thought the thing that I was fascinated by, and I found myself more riveted by the game than I thought it would be, is because he had been so immersed in the season and had played these two teams a bunch of times. He had insight that I just wasn't going to get from Tim McCarver. It would have been impossible. Do you think that color guys, for the most part, should be guys that have recently retired or are between jobs or whatever? How hard is it to combat being out of the game for that long?
I think the key, Bill, for any analyst who wants to be great, is to understand you're in the broadcasting business. You're not in the ex-jock or ex-manager business.
But you can't just carry the weight of, I played.
You know, you come off the field and you go, well, a quarterback thinks, well, excuse me? Well, you were a quarterback, but every quarterback thinks the same thing in every circumstance? Of course not. You can also get too much into the vernacular. When I hear an announcer talk about a three-technique tackle, Collinsworth and I laugh about this.
Right.
If we walk down the street, how many people would know what a three-technique tackle is?
I don't know what that is. I read about sports for a living.
Well, there are gaps. There are A gaps and B gaps and three, and three-technique or the nose or the five. So when I hear this, I'm going, wait a minute. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
Nobody knows. You're not doing a high school clinic. You do television sports. We're in the entertainment business. We're in the information/entertainment business. The great analysts, Madden, Collinsworth, people like this, they understand, okay, they've got this great amount of knowledge. They stay contemporary. They do as much work as anybody. I mean, they work very hard to get to that particular game so they can talk about those particular people in certain circumstances.
Right.
But they know how to entertain you, too. They know how to make it fun. They know how to, you know, people want to hear you, you know, have some humor. You know, when John was the first guy, John Madden, you know, to have the sound effects. And people love that.
Yeah, it seems.
Because not everybody wants to sit there immersed and go, oh, you know, can they seal the edge on the outside? I'm sorry. Millions of people aren't sitting there and doing that. They want to be entertained. And what you have now in television sports, I mean, it's reached the point, it's an art form. Games look phenomenal on television. Now that you've got HD, now that you've got cable cam, now that you've got sideline cameras and you know, cameras that can go everywhere, and guys are mic'd up. I mean, I'm in the business. I'm watching football on television going, this is phenomenal. And it's a one-take business, too. As great as Steven Spielberg might be or Van Zandt or name any director,
Hello?
You don't get take 15. You don't get take 2. You know, I think the guys who direct television sports at the highest level are phenomenal. I'd love to see them start doing some movies, these guys, because you get one shot. You got to get it set up.
Yeah.
I mean, Drew Esikoff is directing the Super Bowl for us. James Harrison's running back a kick 100 yards on a play. Where did that come from? A game-changing thing. You know, oh, my God, he's going down the sideline. He's running through, as I said, the whole state of Arizona. Fitzgerald's trying to get him, you know, he goes out of bounds, has to run through the bench. Like six angles, bang, 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 bang. You saw everything.
How much tape?
Exhilarating.
How much tape do you watch?
Here's how we go about. We watch the game. It's an interesting dynamic. Chris watches a lot of like the coach's tape
because he'll go to like NFL films for the day.
He gets it right. You know, most analysts have the ability, but he'll see it. He'll break it down, and he understands all of that.
And he loves to talk about how he watched the tape.
Well, he does.
Because you got to do that. I would do that.
Well, he watches the tape.
Like, hey, I watched the tape when I saw them on tape.
But he doesn't say I watched the tape as much as some other guys who watch the tape. Because I mean, that's what you're supposed to do to begin with. So of course you're supposed to watch the tape. What I like to do is I watch. Obviously, the game tape, I watch the telecast tape, which is more valuable to me than watching the coach's tape, because Chris can do that, and I know enough about what's going on, but that's going to be Chris's province anyway to do that. What I want to know is, if I'm doing a team, for instance, that's on national television a lot, I want to see what the other broadcasters have talked about. In other words, I might have a great story about some guy.
Or somebody did it already.
They did it, and if you don't watch what, and for instance, if we're doing the Cowboys, and Fox has done it, and Joe Buck and Troy Aikman are doing the game, and they tell a story, and I miss the story that they told the week before, and I come on the air and I went, hey, by the way, isn't this interesting? You feel like a dope,
right?
So that's why I make sure I kind of get it all together. I read everything I can. I want to know what the people who follow that team know and don't know, so that you think you might have a great story, but then you realize, hey, wait a second, this is already a big story down there. Because sometimes you'll come upon that gem where you go, you know what? Nobody knows this.
And plus, you have your enormous gambling problem, so you know what's going on with every game.
You know me. I'm a rascal. Look, we've talked about this before, Bill.
We have.
In life, see, here I am. I'm a great philosopher now, Socrates. Yeah. In life, you have to know what you don't know. Okay?
Yeah.
So here we are. The great thing about broadcasting, and a lot of fans won't understand this, they must think, you know, we have this incredible inside information, which we do. We talk to the coaches. We talk to the players.
You get a little insight from the coaches.
Of course
we do. We're going to attack this guy.
But Bill, at the end of the day, well, yeah, but what does that matter? At the end of the day, if you wanted to make a bet on the game, you have to understand there are 18 million things that go into that.
It's true.
Again, let's go back to the three technique tackle and sealing the edge. And guys betting. I mean, sometimes I see these. I'll hear these commercials, or I have friends who subscribe to these services for $1,000 a week. And I say, what are you doing? Because in 2004 at that stadium when it was raining, and I said, are you out of your mind?
You know, I thought of you last night. There was a great Al Michaels moment. I don't know if you watched the Monday night game.
I have it on tape. I watched the first half
on Tuesday. So Chicago is getting like 5 points. They're down 11. They're driving down. They complete a pass in the 12. The clock's ticking. and there's like a second left, and it's between 0.0 and 0.1. They hike it.
Yeah.
And the Lions don't think that they got the hike off in time, but they did. And Cutler throws across the middle, and the guy's running toward the end zone, and they catch him from behind. He gets tackled on the one, and it was for the cover, and you would have enjoyed it.
This is why
you love this stuff.
I love this stuff, but I don't bet, because first of all, the analysis before the game is the same garbage that you see from stock analysts, right?
Yep.
The one thing you need
Jim
to
Cramer.
Know. Well, whatever, anybody. It's not just the people like on CNBC or Fox Business Channel. It's the analysts. When you see analysts come on the air from companies and they're trying to tell you about a stock, you know what it always has meant to me? I'm trying to dump inventory.
Yeah, please buy this. So
it's garbage. I've made more money through the years investing by shorting stocks that guys were touting 2 days later. Because what they're doing is they're dumping inventory.
That's why you
not
showed
always.
Up in a chariot being held by 12 Roman gladiators.
There you
studio.
Go.
I didn't realize how much money you had
in Jerusalem,
out.
Of course. So, but in football, the thing is, the game is going to be determined by 1,000 factors.
Yeah.
And you can't figure out all of them. And is it fun to bet for people? Of course, for millions of people around this country, it's great to get a few bucks down on a game. For me, if I'm going to gamble, I don't gamble on sports because I know what
well,
I don't
you
know.
You can't, though. I mean, when you're calling games,
I guess
it's like,
no, I don't. And I root for drama. I just all I want is drama.
You love
but
torturing the people who did gamble.
But you see, what I know, look, you've got to have a little rascal.
Of course you do.
And I know people think that the NFL doesn't want us ever to talk about the points.
But yet they find people who don't do the injury report.
Of course.
Yeah.
And I've had more fun through the years saying, well, you know, when the score was 41-0 once in a 49er Bear game, and I said, with about 2 minutes to go, I said, well, you might think this game is over, but it's not over.
Right? And you've never been scolded, right?
Oh, they'll talk to me from time to time about.
Who's they? Mr. Goodell?
No. There'll be some, like, a little undercurrent. Oh, does Al really have
come
to
on, Al.
Do
cut us
this?
Some slack here.
Or, you know,
you have to.
There'll be like a kvetch, you know.
Would anybody be watching a 24-13 game with 20 seconds left?
Hello?
Seriously.
As I always said, if they wanted to stop this, then the sports leagues would band together with Congress and sponsor a bill to stop gambling.
Or how about this?
Yeah, it would
don't
never
publish
happen.
The injury reports.
Yeah.
If you really
yeah,
don't want people to gamble, then don't make the injury reports public. And we find out as the game started that Calvin Johnson's out.
Meanwhile, I mean, ESPN is a major partner of the National Football League.
Yes.
And you still have Hank Goldberg coming on and talking about the Lions. And
they've come a long way.
And Brent, how about Brent Musburger? I love Brent.
Yeah.
I mean, Brent's even more overt than I am about this stuff.
Oh, yeah.
But I
well,
like to...
Same stage you are, though. He doesn't care anymore.
You know
what? What are they going to do? Fire me?
You just have a little
fun. Yeah.
We're having fun with people. That's all it is.
I want to go back to something you said before about you did that Super Bowl, the Card Steelers.
Right.
And afterwards, you were just on such a high that game had gone so great and all that stuff. Let's say you reach a point 4 years from now, you do a game like that. You don't feel that high. You're not feeling that same energy that you knew that once upon a time you had. Is that it? That's when you walk away?
Well, I mean, it would be something like that for sure. Because, I mean, I've
Wouldn't
done
that
this.
Be the litmus test, though, that it's time for you to go if you don't get that rush?
The litmus test will be when I don't want to show up or I'm going, look. I have the greatest job in the world.
But you still love your job.
I hate
so
the traveling. I hate the traveling is insane. I live on the West Coast. The NFL is so Eastern dominant right now. I mean, I have, like, if I get Chicago and New Orleans, they're like home games because they're in the Central time zone, not the Eastern time zone. Those are my home games.
Right.
Dallas is a home game. You know, the 49ers have stunk for years. So have the Raiders. Seattle, you forget about it.
That's why you're really mad at Al Davis, because they never opened Monday Night Football games.
And we couldn't go there anyway because they were always blacked out. They couldn't sell out. So, I mean, in the 90s, on Monday night, it was great because the 49ers were great and the Raiders were good. So we'd be there. We'd be in San Diego. And then, it's just the bane of my existence, but I mean, personal. I mean, Arizona gets good for a while. Now they stink again. So,
right.
I mean, we're not going to wind up going back to Phoenix anytime soon. We have one game. I mean, when the schedule came out this year, I'm looking at this thing and going, wait a minute. I mean, every week there's like a series of six or seven games back east. I mean, December 18th is like, oh, my God, Baltimore at San Diego, in flex. Please, God, don't flex out of this game. It's like I have to root for Baltimore and San Diego.
You drive down to that one.
I pay the $5 toll on the, toll road. It's my favorite moment of putting the $5 in there to save 20 minutes on the freeway.
So you must be over the moon that there might be an L.A. football stadium.
Oh, yeah, but by that time, they'll be wheeling me in there to do the game.
That's fine. You can do it.
They'll open it up with a moment of silence. This guy who did the games for 32 years.
Chris will be behind you holding the wheelchair like this, and you can just hold your mic.
Right.
That could be 2015.
It could be, and conceivably a team could move here even before then and play in the Coliseum or the Rose Bowl.
Conceivably, you could get two teams.
Well, you're not going to get two at first, but
no.
I mean, if they break ground and get this thing going... whoever is going to be the team, whichever team it will be, could come here and either play in the Coliseum or the Rose Bowl.
Pretty interesting.
Yeah, but I mean,
it is crazy that for the last 20 years we haven't had an LA football team.
I've done the primary primetime game in the National Football League for 26 years. I've never done a game in the city of Los Angeles.
Really?
Well, when I started doing it, the Raiders were here, but they would never sell out, so we couldn't do a game in the Coliseum. We'd have to do the Raiders on the road. And the Rams played in Anaheim. Did a few there. So, in Orange County.
Rams played in Anaheim? I don't remember that.
Well, the Rams moved to Anaheim, which opened up the Coliseum for the Raiders to move down from Oakland.
Where did they play in Anaheim? I have no recollection of this.
No,
really?
Anaheim? Yeah.
I don't remember this.
You, the great historian.
I just thought
they
were the L.A. Rams. I thought they played in the
The Rams,
Coliseum.
The Rams played in the Coliseum after they moved here from Cleveland.
Anaheim, no wonder they left.
The end of the 70s. Now, in Anaheim, the Angels had that stadium built.
Right.
And it opened up in 1966 or 5. The Angels originally, when they came out here, played at Old Wrigley Field in Los Angeles. Believe it or not, the minor league stadium.
Old Wrigley Field.
Wrigley
in Los
Field,
Angeles?
Which was
where
down
was
by the Coliseum. It was a junior copy. It was near the Coliseum. It was a junior copy of Wrigley Field in Chicago. They played there their first year, which was 61. The Dodgers were still playing in the Coliseum. Dodger Stadium opens in 62. The Angels and the Dodgers shared Dodger Stadium for 4 years. It was known as Dodger Stadium because they built it, and the Angels didn't want to call it Dodger Stadium, so they made sure their announcers would always say Chavez Ravine. We're playing in Chavez Ravine. Then they built the stadium in Anaheim. The Angels went there, I think, in 66. It was a beautiful baseball stadium. It was much like, you know, Candlestick. When Candlestick was built, it was a baseball stadium.
Yeah.
And then when the 49ers moved in, they made it into this, you know, garbage dump. And it had 65,000 seats. And did the same thing in Anaheim. So here you have a baseball stadium constructed in a certain manner. And it's not even as if it's an oval. Now you surround the outfield with the seats. So it's like 65,000 people, which made it a crappy baseball stadium. And a terrible football stadium. Right. And then all of a sudden the Rams weren't very good. And
that's it.
Now you have the opportunity. So then you had the earthquake here in early 94, which enabled the Coliseum. It enabled Davis to begin to look back north because they wanted it so badly in Oakland. So they gave Davis this incredible deal. So he takes the team back there, moves for a second time. Meanwhile, the Rams then have the opportunity to go to St. Louis because St. Louis had been spurned. When the league expands in the early 90s and they add Jacksonville and Charlotte, what had happened by that point is that Baltimore had already gone to Indianapolis in 1984. St. Louis had gone to Arizona. So the two cities that really want teams in the expansion pool are Baltimore and St. Louis. But they get passed over for Jacksonville and Charlotte.
Jacksonville was a terrible
idea. So then Baltimore goes and gets Cleveland, and St. Louis goes and gets the Rams. There you go. That'll cost you $20 for the history list.
So you think, how many years realistically for you?
More?
Yeah.
You want to throw me out already, right?
I don't want to throw you out. You got to start. You got to be thinking about it, though.
No, you know what? Here's the deal. As I tell my good friends, don't do the math anymore. You know, I know how old I am, but you know what? I feel like I'm about 20. So at the moment, thank God, health is good. The brain sort of still works, I think. You know, do I make mistakes? Of course. Who doesn't make mistakes? You're on for 3 hours. You know, people say, oh, you said this and that. I'm going, excuse me? I'm sorry. You're doing a game in front of 22 million people for 3 hours? You're going to have a couple of bobbles. It's going to happen. I'll know when I can't do it anymore. You know, it'll be a health thing, or it'll be an enthusiasm thing. Look,
I would say for you it would be an enthusiasm.
It might be, but here's the deal. I'll never forget. The guy I loved in this business was Kurt Gowdy. And when I was a kid growing up and Kurt did all the big games, and then I got to actually work with him on the 1972 World Series. I'm a kid. I'm doing the Cincinnati Reds, and we win the pennant, so you get to do the World Series on national television. And Kurt said to me, and he was a mentor for me. In fact, when I was going to Arizona State, the Red Sox were training in Scottsdale, and Kurt was announcing for the Red Sox, and he would listen to my tapes, reel-to-reel tapes. I'd bring it to him. So he was wonderful from the get-go. And I'll never forget, Kurt said, he said, kid, he said, you know, you're going to make it. He said, but I want to tell you something. Down the line, never get jaded. He said that, and it was kind of one of those things where you hear it when you're in your early 20s, and you don't think much about it, but you know what? It resonates. Hmm. I still hear Gowdy's voice in my ear. Don't get jaded. And he's right. Look, of all the jobs you can have in the world, I'm putting mine in the top five. So I've enjoyed it through the years. It's been great. It's been wonderful. It's given my family a really great life, fun, and all of the rest. What are you going to throw it away for at this point? I mean, why? I still like it. I love it. So,
you know,
when you start thinking about, oh, I'm going to retire in X number of years, well why? I know what age I'll become in 5-6 years and all of that stuff, but I think it's up here more than anything else. Don't think about that.
I think, like, maybe an example, I thought Jack Buck the last couple of years. You know, maybe stayed on a little bit too long.
Maybe. Well, Jack might have been having physical issues as well, you know, at that point.
That's part of it, though. If you're breaking down a little bit physically, it's going to affect your voice, your energy, your enthusiasm.
Right.
All that stuff.
Well, but then take somebody like
all things you don't have to worry about right now.
Take somebody like Dick Enberg. You know, Dixon is mid to even maybe late 70s.
No, that's not true. He's 110 years old.
Well, he might be.
No,
he might be. But you know
what? He was born in 1890.
He might as well be like 37. I saw Dick. I mean, Dick. I ran into Dick Costas and I did a baseball game this summer. I hadn't done a baseball game in 15
years.
Yeah,
I want to talk about that.
It was phenomenal.
Yeah.
We had a great time. And the day before, San Diego's in there, and Dick's doing like 100 San Diego games in addition to doing a bunch of tennis. So there's Dick.
It's like a drug.
It's, you know what?
Can't get rid of it.
He enjoys it. He looked good. And I think... You know what? And I'm glad you brought this up now, because I'm thinking of a couple of guys in their 80s. One not with us anymore, Chick Hearn.
Yeah.
The other, Vin Scully, who's still Vin Scully.
Vin Scully is still Vin Scully.
Vin Scully is, and these guys, and I'm thinking to myself, you know what? They're younger. They're younger at heart, and they're younger in their minds, because maybe they're around all these young people, and they're doing what
That's
they love.
Yeah.
And, I mean, Chick Hearn... At the end of the day, you remember, look, to me, Chick and Marv Albert, the greatest basketball announcers of all time. And was Chick making mistakes? Of course. But in his early 80s,
made the game more fun, though.
It was great. You'd listen to Chick, and I drive along, and I'm listening to Vinny, and I'm going, whoa, I'm a child growing up in Brooklyn hearing Vinny. Now I'm in a car in Los Angeles hearing Vinny. It's like the same thing. It's like, whoa. No time has ever elapsed.
Don't
it's
you think you're a little bit of an outlier, as Malcolm Gladwell would say, in that disrespect where you grew up in Brooklyn, you got to hear Vince Scully growing up, and you wanted to be an announcer. Like, that's pretty lucky. You could have been born in Kansas City, and then what happens?
I would have grown up to be...
Like, he had to have had an impact,
Denny Matthews,
right?
Or somebody.
Yeah.
Oh, and there's no question.
You're learning, like, all these little tricks that you don't even know you're learning.
When I'm growing up in Brooklyn, remember, we have three teams there at the time.
Oh,
I've got Mel Allen doing the Yankees. I've got Russ Hodges doing the Giants. I've got Red Barber doing the Dodgers, because Vinny came along as the kid.
I have Red Barber as overrated.
By who?
I don't know. I just wanted to say the controversy.
Where'd that come from? Red Barber's over it.
I heard a couple of old clips. I was like, this Red Barber's kind of mailed it in.
You know, that's where back came from, right?
Which other
guys have stolen. Because he had John Frieda going back, and makes a catch against the wall. But, I had growing up in New York, loving sports, listening to all these guys. Marty Glickman's doing basketball. Chris Schenkel's doing the Giants on radio football, the football Giants. So you're growing up and you're hearing these guys. And there's no question Vinny had a big influence on me, because I learned a lot of baseball from Vince Scully.
Right.
I was a Dodger fan. And then ironically, our family moved to L.A. the same time the Dodgers did. Dodgers leave Brooklyn. I'm heartbroken. My father gets transferred in his job about 6 months later. We're back with the Dodgers. We're back in L.A. So I haven't missed Vinny very often in my life. And then it became, you know, a contemporary of his. And, of course, when I got into to Major League Baseball, and I'm a kid and I'm doing the Cincinnati Reds in 1971, I can't tell you what a thrill it was when I'm doing the same game with Vinny, and Vinny comes to me one day and he says, "Hey, would you be in the pregame show with me?" And I went, "Oh my God,
I sure will.
Kill me and go to heaven right now. I'm on the pregame show with Vin Scully."
You know, it's interesting. When we did our last podcast, I couldn't believe how many. Yeah, I'd gotten to know some announcers and stuff, and they'll email me and stuff. Everybody dorked out that you were on the podcast. And I guess I never thought of you in that term. You know, not to butter you up, but as this guy who is like this role model type icon of basically any under 45 play-by-play announcer, which I thought your life must be pretty interesting with people coming up to you and saying, "Do you have any advice? Thank you for this. Yeah. I modeled after that." That must happen to you a lot, right?
Well, it evolves over time. I got into the business when I was young, got to do some great things, doing the World Series when I'm 26 years old.
Yeah. Yeah, Miracle Advice was your career money shot, basically.
Right, in my early 30s. Go to ABC, do some amazing events. And then it's funny because you always think of yourself as the kid. And I'll never forget, I'm doing a Monday night baseball game in about 1980. Yeah. So now all of a sudden, I'm into my 30s and Steve Sachs, who was playing second base for the Dodgers, we're doing a Dodger game at Dodger Stadium. I had not met Steve, so I'm out on the field before the game, and Sachs comes up to me and says, "Hey," and he grew up in Sacramento. He said, "I used to listen to you when I was a kid and listening to the Giants games." And it was the first time, and I remember thinking, whoa.
How old am I?
I mean, Steve Sachs wasn't that much younger than me, but he was, it was the first time I heard it. And through the years, I was playing in a golf tournament in Vegas a few years ago, and there's not a name drop, but I mean,
I'll be the judge of that.
George Clooney, there's your drop. George Clooney's in
pretty
the room.
Good name drop.
And of course, my wife is there, and she goes, "Oh, God, you gotta go up and say hello." So right. I'm kind of just sitting there, and I'm not gonna go up and say hello to George. What am I gonna do? "Hey, George," blah, blah, blah. He sees me. He comes over and he goes, "Hey," he said, "George Clooney." I go, "Really?" He says, "Why'd you leave Cincinnati?" Now, he had grown up in Cincinnati when I'm doing the Reds, and he's probably 12 or 13.
Yeah.
And he's telling me, he's listening to me, when we're on the West Coast, and he would be like with his transistor radio in bed at night listening to the games on the coast.
Wow.
And he was upset.
The big red machine.
He was so upset when I left after 3 years. And by the way, Marty Brenneman came in, and that's worked out great for them because Marty's still there. But I said to Clooney, I said, "George, they tripled my salary." He says, "Okay, now I'll buy it." They did it. I left to go to the Giants at that point because they did triple my salary. But it was so funny to run into these people who hear you as kids. And again, not a name drop thing, but David Letterman, when he had the
another NBA, good name drop.
There you go. I'm not throwing the big ones out
at
you.
Good.
Letterman is doing his NBC show before he goes to CBS, and they want me on the show. So I'm in New York, and I'm there. And I'm in the dressing room at 30 Rock. These are the years when I'm at ABC doing Monday night. And
before we traded you,
correct. Letterman comes into the dressing room. "Hey, how are you?" The whole thing. And Bobby Morton was the producer of the show, and Morty comes in. He goes, "Holy mackerel!" He says, "He never does that." I said, "What are you talking about? He never comes into anybody's dressing room." I said, "Well, what's the deal here?" Turns out, when Letterman's growing up in Indianapolis, and I'm doing the Reds,
yeah.
The Reds are like the Indianapolis.
Oh,
team.
Yeah.
So David's hearing me on the radio, so I'm like a part of their growing up, even though I'm not much older than they are. So it's a weird deal. It's true.
You're always going to love the announcers the most that you listen to when you're between 9 and 16.
Absolutely.
They're always going to be the most.
Right, because they're part of your family.
Like Fred Cusack, the Bruins announcer, is my number one favorite announcer of all time. I just loved him. I hear his voice. I just get misty.
Yeah, great voice.
Yeah, he was great. He would have a great score. Like, he was just the best goal calls and all that. But
yeah,
he was. And we had Johnny, obviously. But then Johnny Most.
Sure.
Near the end.
Got a little dark
near the end with Johnny.
Right.
He was setting himself on fire in the booth with cigarettes and stuff. Do you think it is a weird industry in the sense that, you know, like, let's say I'm a 32-year-old announcer right now, and I'm good. But I'm looking at Monday Night Football, you're not going anywhere. CBS Football, Jim Nance isn't going anywhere. Tirico, he's not going anywhere. You look at basketball, you got Marv Albert, he's not going anywhere. Mike Breen does a great job, he's not going anywhere. You go to baseball, Joe Buck, well, he's not going to go anywhere. Like, it's really like once you get in, you're in. But I do wonder if there are some really good announcers that just might not get a break. It's possible, right?
Well,
just because it's so hard to get a job.
Yes and no. And I say that because when I'm coming into the business, I think it's even harder.
You're talking about the 70s.
You're right.
We had less jobs. Yeah.
Well, fewer jobs, no cable television.
Good point.
Kurt Gowdy's doing the World Series, the Super Bowl, you know, the top NFL game, and the Final Four. So
he had all three of those?
He had all three of them.
Wow.
Yes, he did. So, and ABC's got the Olympics. So there, you only have X number of outlets.
Yeah.
So now there are more opportunities for young people. I do a lot of, you know,
that's a really good
speaking
point.
At schools and all of that, and they're asking, well, how do you do this?
How do you break in? What do I need to do?
Look, what do you do? And it's that the first job is very, very hard. You need some luck.
Yeah.
Also, but in a way, you know, when I'm trying to get into the business, what am I doing? I'm writing handwritten letters, sending them to minor league baseball teams. Not knowing, you know, if anybody's ever going to read it, going to a post office, putting stamps on them, sending them out, waiting every day to see if you're getting any response to these things, which were normally like form letters saying thanks for your interest, but there's nothing happening. Now, at least, with the communication the way it is, you can email and almost instantaneously find out if there's something to be pursued here.
Yeah.
You don't have to wait. I can't tell you. I used to go to the mailbox, you know, and see stationery from, you know, the St. Louis Cardinals or somebody. Wow, yeah, I'm getting a letter back from maybe Bing Devine. Now it's instantaneous. It's faster. It's easier to network. And a lot of it is, you know, being in the right place at the right time. I mean, I walked in. My first job was announcing for the Hawaii Islanders minor league baseball in 1968.
Nice caps.
It's what?
Good caps, the Hawaii Islanders. Nice cap, like, nice logo.
Not as good as it should have been. I mean, yeah, they had the King Kamehameha stuff going on and all that stuff. But we had, we had guys like Bo Belinsky pitching on that team, and it was crazy. But I walked in there at a time when their announcer had been called up by his reserve unit. So I had interviewed for the job. I had met a guy named Jack Quinn, who was the general manager of the team. I'd gone over there. He said, well, we have nothing available right now. Okay. So, I mean, that was a big trip I made. I went to Hawaii to be interviewed. And then he needed an announcer, like, right away. Mm. And I get the call. Now, he didn't know for how long, because their announcer at that time was going to get called up but might not leave the islands. And so who knows? He just needed a guy to fill in just in case. And I get on the plane the next day, and away we go. Now, if that doesn't happen, Bill, I'm not saying, well, this doesn't happen, but you begin to wonder, what if you're spinning around? What if you're on the hamster wheel for 6 or 7 years, and it doesn't happen for you? And that's the hard thing to tell, you know, the kids who want to get into the business, and you know, what's the key to getting in? I'm going, I can't give you a key. All I can say is be ready, because if you get the opportunity – you know, you're going to get it if you get the chance. It's the big if, but then you've got to be ready to exploit it and take advantage of it. And fortunately, I was. You know, I knew a lot about baseball, and I'd done a lot of broadcasting in college at Arizona State. I had called like 200 baseball games, so at least I had some experience. And I tell these kids, you've got to be able to, you know, get on your campus station. I'm on my campus station at Arizona State, and playing in for our baseball team were Sal Bando, Rick Monday, and Reggie Jackson.
Oh, my God.
They're on my audition tape for the Hawaii Islanders.
So you lucked out with that and Vin Scully as a kid.
And Vin Scully.
Those are two nice ones.
Right. And I walk into Hawaii at the right time, and bang, and away we go and become the most successful minor league franchise in baseball at that time. And
you must.
It's serendipitous. It really is.
You must always be on the lookout. I would call this the, that guy might take my job someday syndrome. I do it, too, with writers. I mean, there must be a couple guys out there that you look at and you go, oh, that guy's coming on. Did anybody jump to mind?
I mean,
I'm talking young.
Yeah, I hear some good young guys. I mean, Dan Shulman's doing baseball for ESPN.
Dan Shulman,
he does a real nice job. I heard him on the radio last night. I mean, there are guys who come along. You know, Mike Tirico, I heard for years, you know, ascending. I mean, there are a number of people. I mean, look, there are the plum premium jobs. You know, Monday Night Football, Sunday Night Football, postseason baseball, the big NBA games, and all of that. But nobody lasts forever. I mean, look, I've had a good long run. Joe Buck's had a good long run, when you think about it. Joe, as young as Joe is,
he's been out for a long time.
And Jim Nance has had a good long run already. I mean, you think of those are, you know, fairly young guys.
You never did golf, right? That was one, and in the whole Al Michaels legacy, you did Olympics, you did World Series, Super Bowl,
right?
You did NBA Finals,
right? I hosted the Stanley Cup Finals.
Hosted Stanley Cup, but didn't announce it.
Correct. Didn't do the play-by-play, but I hosted
Kentucky Derby.
Kentucky Derby, Indy 500 host.
Right. You did Olympics track and field.
Did all of Carl Lewis's gold medals.
Miracle of Nice, greatest sports game that's ever happened.
I'll buy that.
But no golf.
I've done four golf events. Here's what they were.
That's okay.
99, 2000, 01, and 02. When ABC decided to put Tiger Woods on primetime television.
Oh, that skins thing.
No, it wasn't the skins thing. This was head-to-head. So they make a deal in 99. The first one is they wanted me to do golf, but I didn't start playing golf till the early 90s, and I wanted to play golf.
And now you're dressed to play golf.
Now I'm going to play golf when we're done with this, of course. So that's all I do is I'm always dressed to play golf. So in 99, they're going to have Tiger against David Duval, who was actually number one in the world at that
during
time.
During his next 2 year run.
Right. It's the ascending Tiger. It's the whole thing. And here's Tiger, you know, coming into full bloom. And it's going to be at the Sherwood Country Club here in Southern California.
Oh.
And we're going to start it at 5 o'clock. You know, it's the summertime, so it's going to be light. Late, but then they're going to put some lights on the last three holes and see if we can finish.
I remember,
you know,
this.
With a different feeling, a different look. So the two prior years, Tiger's playing in the skins game out in the desert, and ABC's doing it. I'm doing Monday Night Football. So at halftime in a late November game each year, I interviewed Tiger in a two-way. I'm in Miami, he's in Los Angeles. I'm in Washington, he was wherever he was. So we're doing a two-way interview just to promote that. So I had never met him, but I had talked to him on the phone. And the first time I talked to him before we do the interview that night, hey, you know, Ty, I'm a big fan, you know, golf, and I'm born to Bel Air, and we had a lot of mutual friends. And at the end of it, I said, okay, give me a swing thought. So we start laughing, and he's giving me a couple of tips. The next year, we have the same conversation. I said, what's tonight's swing thought? And he's asking me how my game is and all that.
Yeah.
So now it's 99, and he had just won, I think, the Firestone event in Akron the day before. And now he flies in. He lands in L.A. at like 2 o'clock.
This is probably like his best year, if I remember correctly.
Or 99,
2000.
He's pretty
hitting his prime. Yeah.
Pretty close. And I had not met him physically. So he comes out. We're going on there at 5 o'clock. So at about 4:15, he went out and he played a couple of holes, and now he's on the practice green. He's putting. So I go down. I leave the booth, and I go down just to say hello. I walk up and say hi to him, and he goes, how's your game? I said, it stinks. He says, well, with your schedule, you probably don't get – this is June now. With your schedule, you probably don't get to play very much. Not really. I said, my big fear in life is that my ultimate boss, Michael Eisner, running Disney at the time, who belongs to Bel Air, God forbid he should ever show up at the club, because if he did, he'd look at the handicap sheet and, you know, he'd see a 16 handicap for me. That wouldn't give him any pause. But under rounds this month for June, he would have seen 26. And Tiger says, you play more than I do. So I wind up doing golf. We did that event with Mike Tirico. Tirico and I shared the host duties with Curtis Strange, Judy Rankin, Jimmy Roberts was with us too. And then we moved it out to the desert for.
You know what? I'm adding that to your resume. You did Tiger in his prime.
I did Tiger in his prime.
But no tennis, though.
Yes, I have. I did tennis with Arthur. I did the Tournament of Champions probably three times in the late 70s,
that's
early
80s. Kind of a reach.
Wait a minute. I worked
with
Arthur.
Do you have a major?
No majors, but I've done Connors. I've done McEnroe in matches. I did the Tournament of Champions.
So late 70s tennis, you're right.
Right. I went to Boca Raton. I did when they started the event down there, whatever they call that thing now. I worked with Arthur. I worked with Cliff Drysdale.
All right. How about what else?
Pam Shriver was with us. I did a Martina match. I've announced matches played by Martina, Chris Evert, Connors, McEnroe.
That's pretty good. Borger. How about Battle Network Stars?
Did that too. Well, I didn't.
You did do Battle Network
Stars. I did a whole bunch of superstars.
Oh yeah, superstars.
Remember,
counts.
I did a ton.
So you did some trash TV during the trash TV era.
Plenty of trash TV. I probably did 15 of those.
What about women's sports?
I did women's superstars.
Women's superstars.
Of course.
I don't know if I saw that one.
I did the women's superstars. Oh, you're going to love this story.
This is
great.
Women's superstars.
Listen to this. You're going to love this. So I'm doing women's superstars. Along we have, there's like three superstar shows going on at one time. It's in Freeport in the Bahamas.
They were smart with where they used to put that stuff.
Right, but they put it in Rotunda, Florida. You couldn't find the place. They moved it to Freeport, and they did super teams in Hawaii. That was great. Did a bunch of those. So we're down in the Bahamas, and in those years, I'm doing Monday Night Baseball, going back and forth with any number of partners, but Don Drysdale is one of my partners. Don would come in and out. So Don is doing it with me. I'm doing A games, B games. We're all over the place. So Drysdale's a partner. I got to fold one other thing in here, too.
Yeah.
I did UCLA basketball.
I forgot to mention that.
For 2 years.
I did
John Wooden's last 2 years and Walton's final year, and then Walton left, and I did Wooden's last year when he won the championship.
That's pretty good.
So, and Dave Myers is playing on that team. He gets into this story, too. All right. So we're doing the women's superstars. Drysdale and I, we get there a couple of nights before. We're sitting in the bar. And I got Bill Russell is going to be on the show, too. Basketball Bill Russell. I got Jackie Stewart. I've got 14 different partners on 10 shows. So we're sitting at the bar with Drysdale.
And that sounds like you're making this story up.
I'm making this story up. But there we are. So Don and I are in the bar.
And a midget walks in.
The hotel. No, it wasn't a midget. It was a very tall woman, in fact. It was exactly the opposite. So in walks a woman who I know. And how do I know her? Dave Myers' sister.
Annie Myers, the basketball player.
So Annie walks in because I had done UCLA, and I had interviewed Annie because she's now coming up as a basketball player at UCLA. I introduced Ann Myers.
They got married.
Don Drysdale. Yes, they did.
Oh, I'm adding that to your resume.
With three kids. How's that?
That's pretty good.
I talked to Annie all the time. And, of course, Don died way too early and too, much, much too young. One of the saddest Santa services ever. I mean, there's
really?
Annie. Well, Annie had three young kids, and Don dies.
How old was he?
Don was late 50s, maybe.
Ah.
Yeah, Don died in Montreal. Don was doing remember, Don, in addition to doing ABC, was doing the Dodgers. He was Vinny's partner.
Right.
They were in Montreal. Don goes to his room after a game one night. Dies of a heart attack. They didn't find him until the next day, and it took a week and a half to get the body. Because you die in another country, here, and I tell you, the Don Drysdale service was about as sad as anything I've ever seen.
Really?
Well, I mean, Annie's got three young kids at that point. You're sitting there.
Met a lot of people over the years, and
it's when you think about this stuff, go, wow, it's something. It was tons of fun. I mean, it was just it's great.
When we the last
you
time
want to ghostwrite my book.
You never wrote a book, right?
I haven't written a book. I'm trying to find the right guy to collaborate with.
It should just be a guy that you sit in a room with and you tell stories to, and then they just write.
No, but it's got to be my voice. I hate these as told to where it's not somebody's voice.
Would you read the Agassi book?
Very interesting you mentioned that.
That was the best kind
Moringer, of biography. J.R. Moringer wrote it when he couldn't even find his name in it.
No,
I looked at that book.
He didn't want it to be on there.
I looked at that book. Here's an interesting thing. We'll break some ground here with this here so that we'll get some interesting feedback to this. I don't know Agassi. I've never met him. But I read the book, and I found the book to be very interesting. I found Andre to be very, you know, a pretty fascinating character. I gave the book, or I gave 12 pages to somebody who knows Agassi very well. And I said, do me a favor. Is this what he sounds like? And the guy called me back, and he said, it's what he thinks, but now not how he would say it. Which I thought was very interesting. Now, again, maybe he'd sort of say it that way, and I don't want to say that, you know, Mohringer didn't catch it. But to me, I'm so anal, I'd want it to be, this is how I would say it. Because I can't sit and write. I love to write, but I obsess over it. Peter King asked me to write his Monday Morning Quarterback column, which I did during the summer. And I thought, all right, well, I'll have a little fun with this thing. Next thing I know, I spent like 35 hours. I'm going back and forth and up and down. I'm out of my mind by the time this thing, you know, and then it just evaporates, you know, it plays 1 week. I got some nice feedback from it, but I was much too anal about it. I can't sit there and go through every freaking preposition.
The last time you were on, we ran out of time right as you were about to tell O.J. Carche stories.
I had to go to the bathroom.
You had to go to the bathroom, and then we realized we're at the hour 20 mark. What are we at now? Okay. You owe us a couple of O.J. Carche stories.
A couple of
You were prominently involved in the O.J. Carche somehow.
The coverage, yeah.
Hold on. I have a couple more things you were prominently involved with. You were also the Dennis Miller experiment.
Of course.
Which I don't think
we need to make this like a 9-part series.
Well, know? Yeah, earthquake we've talked about. Rod Tidwell,
Jerry Maguire.
Which is
where do you want to go?
Still
where,
holds
you,
out. I'm just saying all the basketball.
Basketball, right?
And then finally the O.J. Carches, which the odds of you being involved in that are just like 1 in 200. All of a sudden, you're involved in one of the seminal moments of it. Like, how do you even get involved in that?
Well, I knew O.J. very well, obviously. I worked. Right. O.J. was one of my partners on the 84 Olympics going all the way back.
I didn't know that.
We did all the track and field.
Yeah.
He did the sprints. I had like 9 different people. I had Dwight Stones doing this and that. I had Marty LaQuarrie doing the distance races and the whole thing, doing the marathon. Catherine Switzer on the marathon, 100 people. But OJ did all the sprints. So in fact, OJ was with me on all. If you go back to Carl Lewis's medals, it's OJ calling it with me at the Coliseum. OJ lived in my neighborhood too,
Brentwood,
and
right.
I used to play a lot of tennis.
He ruined Brentwood for about 10 years.
It was different. It was a
tough time for the Brentwood residents.
And then as soon as the OJ thing starts to fade, who else came out of Brentwood? Monica Lewinsky.
Oh,
hello.
At that point,
I called it the late great Brentwood. But anyways, we've come back. So I knew OJ. I knew all of the players in this whole thing, because I played a ton of tennis at OJ's house, knew Nicole very well.
At OJ's house?
Yeah. Because OJ lived in the neighborhood. So in the years before I'm playing golf,
OJ would be like,
tennis.
Hey, Al, I'm thinking about playing doubles today.
Singles. We play singles all the time.
You play singles tennis with OJ Simpson?
Of course, in the late 80s to stay in shape. And then OJ hurt his
knee. Who would win?
It was fairly competitive. I mean, we
really?
Were good. Neither of us were that good, but I mean, we'd run around and, you know, and we'd have a lot of fun. And he had a court at his house, and then he had that little area behind the court, and you know, where he'd have those 3 bedrooms. From people who know enough about the history of this will remember
the Cato area.
Hello.
Oh.
So. And there was any number of characters used to kind of come and go, emerge. So I guess I met Cato at one point. But I knew all of the players in this whole thing. So this thing happens.
When you say the players, you mean like Shapiro, Kardashian, all those people?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I knew, I didn't know Faye Resnick, but I knew just about
Peter
everybody
Marcus
else.
Allen.
Of course.
Right.
So Marcus Allen. Remember, Marcus and I had done the go back to what we started talking about at the top, the Al Davis thing. The whole world is now connected.
Yeah.
So, all right, this thing happens, and, of course, I'm at ABC, so I know a lot of information. I don't know what happened on Bundy Drive, but, I mean, I know the people. I know what's going on.
Let's go back to we find out that OJ's ex-wife and a waiter have been murdered.
Correct.
And
on a Sunday
OJ
night.
OJ is in Chicago.
Correct.
You get word. Do you think anything's fishy at that point?
Well, I had flown back that Sunday. I'd done the Belmont the day before, flown back. So ironic.
You know, you talk about name drops. You have sport drops.
Well, yeah,
like, I was flying back. I was doing like the Belmont,
Bill, but here's the deal. I'm a journalist, and I want to be.
I know.
Despite what any print journalist thinks, I want to be factually correct.
So you come back from the Belmont.
I come back from the Belmont. I'm trying to set the scene here.
Right.
So I come back. This is crazy too. So this is when I start to play golf. And OJ's playing golf. So I am looking for a game on Monday. So I come home on Sunday. We landed at about 6 o'clock. And I'm trying to put together a golf game for the next day. And I was going to leave a message on OJ's machine. But for some reason, I got distracted or way late. So I never did. That's the Sunday night. So then I'm playing golf. I go up on Monday, and I hear about this thing. I go, what? So first of all, there's a complete state of disbelief. It's like, what happened? Who? What went on here?
In Brentwood?
But Nicole is murdered. Yeah. I didn't know Ron Goldman, by the way.
Right.
I said I didn't know Resnick. I didn't know Goldman either. But I mean, you're just in shock. What? What happened? The whole thing. And now it's obviously a huge story. I'm trying to collect some facts. As the days progress that week, and of course it's a gigantic story, and ABC News is now calling me to say, do you know this person? Who's Kardashian? What about Shapiro? Blah, blah, blah. What about Al Cowlings? So I knew everybody. Cowling. When OJ had to stop playing tennis, I would play tennis with Cowling. Cowling's
AC.
AC. So
you know this is, goddammit.
I know a lot about a lot, but I don't know what happened, obviously. But I'm helping Ted Koppel and the other people like at Nightline, because there's a lot of misinformation, factual misinformation.
So this is the day of the car chase, the night of the car
chase. Well, this is that whole week.
Okay.
Remember
when did the thing happen?
I knew that OJ was not at the house. I think it was like Tuesday night when they had, you know, a million trucks were camped outside, and I knew he'd gone to Kardashian's house. I knew it. So I called Koppel, and I said, Ted, don't get swept up in what they're reporting. I can't tell you where he is, but he's not in the house.
Mm.
So ABC was way ahead of everybody on a lot of this stuff, because we had some...
Get some inside Brentwood info.
We had some very good inside information. All right, so now you fast forward to the chase. So what happens during the chase, it's Friday, and... they want me to go on Nightline. And at this point, OJ is now... He's going to be taken into custody at Kardashian's house, and now he's gone. So can I go on? And I had been doing a bunch of stuff for them, both on and off the air.
Right.
But a lot of it was, you know, behind the scenes, telling them what certain things that were happening. So... that night, I owned a horse that was racing at Hollywood Park. There was night racing. This is crazy. You can't make this crap up. So I say, listen.
What was the horse's name?
Barack, believe it or not. Not as in Barack Obama. B-A-R-R-A-Q. Named for the horse that transported Muhammad to heaven.
Barack.
The horse's name was Barack. We're making this. Don't get me waylaid here. Hold on a second. The horse is Barack. Pretty good allowance runner.
Right.
Owned him with a friend of mine, a lawyer in Century City. He's racing in Hollywood that night. First post is 9 o'clock. They had night racing in Hollywood. So I tell the guys, I said, listen, I said, I can't be down at ABC. My horse is running. It may be his last race. Blah, 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 blah. Can we do this on a two-way? We'll find a place in Hollywood Park. Sure, we'll do it. They call me back at about 4 o'clock. Can't do it. Can you come down? We'll tape it. We'll tape it at ABC, Prospect and Talmadge. Fine. So I go down to ABC, tape this thing at about 5:15, and Koppel's back in New York. Okay, so I'm on Nightline. I get up to go to the parking lot, to go to Hollywood Park, and what happens? They found OJ on the freeway. There's OJ. There he is. There's OJ and with Cowlings around on the freeway.
Going 50 miles an hour.
Live.
Yeah.
Well, so I'm starting to walk out and somebody grabs me. No, get over here. They put me on the set. So here I am.
Now you're like a news anchor.
He'd already done the earthquake.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
I mean, why not? So I'm on the set with Bill Redeker and Judy Muller are here. Jennings is in New York. Koppel's in Washington. And then Barbara Walters has to get involved in this, too. God forbid, because it's the night of 2020. So now she wants to have some action as well. So and she comes around 7 o'clock. But this time, OJ is now in the driveway. And he's sitting in the driveway. And, you know, I'm going back and forth with Jennings on a two-way. And Jennings is interviewing certain people. And Judy Mueller has her information. Redeker has his. Barbara Walters now has to, you know, it's 10 o'clock, so it's 20:20 time. So Barbara needs to be in there. So
She wants in.
She's got to be in
this. It's a great night for her to be in.
Right, of course. Yeah. How can you possibly miss this? And she couldn't get in until 10 o'clock. It's 20 time for 20:20. So here comes Barbara. And all of a sudden, Barbara comes in and says, does anybody know how old OJ is? And I looked at Redeker and and I can imagine, you know, Jennings in New York was going, all right, so this, now Barbara has to get into this thing. The next thing that happens, must be around, I guess, 7:15 out here or so, Peter says on the air, and again, he's back, you know, I'm just an adjunct out here.
But yeah.
Jennings says, okay, right now, he said, on the phone, we have a neighbor of Mr. Simpson, Mr. Huggins, is it? Yeah. You hear the voice.
Oh, God.
And Mr. Huggins apparently lives across the street. Mr. Huggins, what can you tell us? Well, you know, I can see OJ, and he looks scared. So I'm sitting there with Redeker, and I'm going, oh, jeez.
Oh, no.
I mean, so I know most of the neighbors. I don't know Mr. Huggins, but Mr. Huggins is saying things that this is a put-on.
Yeah.
So Peter is now interviewing him for about 2 minutes. I can't believe that they didn't pull the plug on this guy.
He's Canadian. It's Canadian or
well, no,
trusting.
But somebody,
very trusting
somebody,
people.
Somebody should have pulled the plug.
Right.
Even if Peter's on the air, I mean, somebody needs to say this is not the right deal. And, of course, the call ends with the guy saying, and Baba Booey to you all. Hello. It's Howard Stern. It's yeah. Captain Jenks. So I know. I'm a huge Howard Stern fan.
Yeah.
Been on the show a bunch of times. I know who Captain Jenks is. I know what's going on. Meanwhile, I can't get on the air here because, you know, Peter now signs off as if the guy had some sort of legitimacy. About 2 minutes later, I have to come on and clean this thing up because what's going through my brain, here I am on national television, millions of people watching. This whole thing is crazier than a loon. And I now have to mention that that's a phony phone call, knowing that for the rest of my life, Howard Stern will be playing this on his show forever, which, of course, he has
yeah,
been.
He's got a lot of match.
Right. So I'm doing this, and I have to tread very carefully. And I said, Peter, I said, lest anyone think. Now, lest is a word I've never used in my life to that point.
I haven't heard it in 2 years.
Lest, L-E-S-T, yeah. I've never used it. And they make fun of it. I did a promo now. Robin loves the fact that, you know, every time my lest. Name gets mentioned, Robin Quivers will mention, you know, Al, you know, he hasn't used lest in a while. So I have to tread so carefully. It's the hardest, you know, I have to think to, you know, make sure the words came. Because I don't want to diss Howard.
Yeah.
But I had to let people know. So I said, let's anyone think that was a legitimate phone call. It was not. There was a code phrase that was used at the end of Mr. Huggins' phone call, which indicated an acknowledgement of a certain radio talk show host. I mean, I sound like a freaking lawyer at this point.
Yeah.
And so I just wanted people to know that was not legitimate. And Jennings says, well, you have him on every coast. And that got me out of it. Now, of course, I get a call on Monday. I know, you know.
You know
the CERN show, start at 6 o'clock in the morning. They're playing it like 800 times.
It's probably the biggest moment in the history of the show.
Well, it was close. And then, of course, about 6 months later, Howard said, you got to come in and talk about it. And I did, and that's when we started talking about, you know, lest. Does anybody think I'm not having fun doing this with you? I am. This is pretty good.
And the weird part of the OJ thing, not just that you were involved, but also you had announced a bunch of different games with him. And
yeah. Events.
I mean,
and
I would think he was at least somewhere between an acquaintance and a real friend, right?
Yeah, I mean, I would consider him at that point, he was a good friend. And I knew Nicole very well. I mean, Nicole and OJ, my wife and I, went to dinner
Double date?
10 times.
Double dated with the Simpsons?
Well, they lived in the neighborhood. Yeah, yeah.
Al
but,
Michaels.
Remember, but OJ was all over Brentwood. Remember, yeah. OJ was, you'd see OJ all over the place. I mean, he was the unofficial mayor of Brentwood.
When you next come back on the podcast, I'm going to do my top 12 amazing things that involve Al Michaels, and I'm going to have you rank them. I think double dating with the Simpsons is in the top 7.
Do you know what?
It's not over the Miracle on Ice or anything, but...
Yeah, I tell you what, when Neil Armstrong stepped out on the moon that day...
Were you there?
I was there. I was there.
Never knew. So what do you have this Sunday night? What's the game?
We have Chicago hosting Minnesota. What can I tell you?
What's the next really good game you have?
Well, then we have Indianapolis at the Saints.
Oh, God. Get rid of, Peyton Manning's hurt.
I heard.
Yeah, he's not playing.
I heard
yeah,
Peyton's hurt. I heard that...
he's not healthy.
Right. Ted Marchabrota may come back and coach that game. The next one we have... I'll tell you what's an interesting game. Dallas goes to Philadelphia.
Ooh.
In 3 weeks.
Philly could be like 2-5 at
well,
that
you don't
point.
Know.
Yeah,
I mean,
who
you know,
knows?
You know, it's funny. Obviously, you'd love to have two undefeated teams, but to me, I think it's dramatic and exciting when teams, people are going, what's going on with
right.
that team?
Philly's been good for the league this season.
Philly's exactly.
It's a nice polarizing, what the hell's going on?
Yeah, don't doubt it to Andy Reid. Hasn't been,
no.
But look, the great thing, we understand... Football's drama, and the NFL is the highest drama, the highest in terms of reality television. There's nothing like it. And so there's the good and the bad. Sure, you want Green Bay. Sure, you want Aaron Rodgers. I mean, they're playing so well right now, and Rodgers is over the moon. But then again, on the other side, what in the world's going on with a team like Philadelphia? So they do make for good television.
Unfortunately, you don't get to do the Thanksgiving Detroit-Green Bay 10-0 versus 9-0 game, which is like a sign of the apocalypse, I think.
I want to be a Thanksgiving dinner with
who
my
knew?
Family.
Who knew Lions-Packers would be amazing on Thanksgiving?
Right. Well, that's why we love the NFL.
There we go.
We'll
All right,
see.
Go play golf.
I'm going.
I'll try to figure out more stories that you didn't tell for the next time you come on.
We've got a ton more.
Thanks for coming to the studio.
We're scratching the surface. I love
yeah.
this. It's pretty cool. This
yeah,
is
it's pretty good. Done. All right. Thank you very much.
Enjoy it, Phil. Take care, man.
Whoa.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at Podcenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.